WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Hey, let me say hi to Saddam.
Okay, hold on a second. Saddam, are you still there?
Who is that? One of your Jewish friends?
No. Well, yes.
Hey, Saddam.
Monica, you never call me anymore. Monica, oh, thanks for the beret. I love it. I love it.
Everyone is fair game for satire on Saturday Night Live. The show, which began as a late-night experiment in 1975, is now a TV institution. My guests Tom Shales and James Andrew Miller have written a new book called Live from New York, an uncensored history of Saturday Night Live, as told by its stars, writers, and guests. Shales won a Pulitzer Prize for his TV criticism in The Washington Post. He's also reviewed movies for NPR's Morning Edition. Miller has written for TV and movies and is the author of a book about the Senate. Miller and Shales both think the funniest cast was the original one, Dan Aykroyd, John Belushi, Chevy Chase, Jane Curtin, Garrett Morris, Lorraine Newman, and Gilda Radner. Here's some of their work.
Yes?
Mrs. Arlsberg.
Who?
Mrs. Baldwin.
Who is it?
Flowers.
Flowers for whom?
Plumber, ma'am.
I don't need a plumber. You're that clever shark, aren't you?
Candy Graham.
I just think that, well, you should from now on try to do your best, okay?
Oh, yes, dear, and I'm very, very sorry, and I promise from now on I will do my best.
See that you do.
Bitch.
I'm gonna get me a shotgun and kill all the whiteys I see.
Eggs, couple of eggs, couple of eggs, and over lightly with sausage, café.
No eggs.
Cheeseburger. When do you stop serving breakfast?
No breakfast.
Nope. All right, I just want a couple of eggs.
No breakfast, cheeseburger, huh?
Shut up, I don't want a cheeseburger.
Come on, don't give me that. Come on, let's go. We gotta have turnover. We want a cheeseburger? Come on, everybody get a cheeseburger. You want a cheeseburger? Come on, cheeseburger.
I don't want a cheeseburger. It's too early for a cheeseburger.
Too early for a cheeseburger? Look, cheeseburger.
The impression I get from your book is that of all the performers on Saturday Night Live, particularly the ones from the early years, that Chevy Chase was the least popular, and that he particularly didn't get along with John Belushi. So what was it that made Chevy Chase so unanimously unpopular?
Well, in John's case, though, it was a reversal of roles, because in the National Lampoon stage show, John was the star and dominant, and indeed, he's electrifying in person, and Chevy was a supporting player, more or less. But when you switch it around to television, Chevy was a far more telegenic performer. And if Marshall McLuhan was right, that it's a cool medium, then it makes sense that Chevy, who's a much cooler personality, would come through much better on TV, whereas Belushi, who's a very hot, explosive personality, you know, might not. It took a lot of exposure to John Belushi before people got used to him. And in fact, he would have to lampoon his own kind of explosiveness when he would do those hilarious commentaries on the news, twirling himself around into a fury, and then he'd sort of fly into the air and disappear behind the desk. But, you know, if there was an animosity between John and Chevy, it's not all Chevy's fault. But Chevy does have a naturally kind of abrasive, irritating personality. Would you say irritating or just...
Yes, I think in the first season, particularly because he broke out as a star and they didn't, there, you know, you had the jealousy factor right away. And then, you know, by Chevy's own admission, he did have a hard time dealing with stardom, including some difficulties with drugs. And I think that that manifests itself in rather mean ways towards people.
He has a knack. Chevy has this strange knack for saying the first thing that pops into his head, no matter how mean it is. And I've seen him, you know, we had many more examples of this than we even put in the book. And I guess Chevy's feeling that we picked on him, but we didn't. We just reported what people said. I mean, I've been in a room with him when someone brought in some iced tea for him and accidentally spilled a little on the rug. And Chevy just became just virulently abusive to this kid, one of the aides, you know, whatever they call him, production assistant. And the kid was trembling. And I thought, well, why does Chevy, a big star, have to yell at this kid and make him miserable? It's something is wrong with his personality. And whatever his talents are, and they're immense, he has this thing to overcome. He's rubbed a million people the wrong way.
You write a little bit about the some of the conflicts and tensions in the early days of Saturday Night Live between the male and the female performers. Lorraine Newman says, the boys got away with a lot. They were bad and we were good. We were punctual, they were late. We were clean, they were dirty. We were prepared and they weren't. Then a couple of people talk about how John Belushi wouldn't be in sketches written by women.
In fact, one of the things that Lorne used to do was he used to either use a male writer's name or just keep a female writer's name off the sketch if he wanted John to do it. John had some very peculiar ideas, first of all, about television. His wife, Judy Belushi, told us about the fact that their television at home was covered with spit because he would love to spit at the TV. He really had to be convinced to do Saturday Night Live by a lot of people because he thought television was an inferior art. Couple that with the fact that he was not misogynistic, but he really felt like, as Rosie Schuster said to me, who was one of the writers on Saturday Night Live, he didn't really believe that women could be funny. And so he had a hard time with the idea of a woman writing a sketch for him.
What impact do you think John Belushi's death from an overdose had on the people who started Saturday Night Live with him?
One effect it had upon them was they all stopped doing drugs, at least for a few minutes. And some of them even stopped doing smoking pot, I think, which, you know, pot around the Saturday Night Live offices on the 17th floor was like Coca-Cola around a normal office. I remember Lorne showing me through once, and we opened the door to Tom Davis and Al Franken's office, and then this cloud of smoke rolled out like, you know, fog over San Francisco Bay. It was marijuana smoke. And so after John's death, I think, though, they suddenly became aware that there could be dire consequences to all this recreational drug use.
Although it should be pointed out that, as Carrie Fisher says, the very first question that a lot of them asked was, what was he doing? Because they were worried about, you know, he was doing something that they were doing. It turned out that they weren't freebasing heroin, so their first initial reaction was, well, that's okay, because we're not doing that.
Right. Well, their first reaction was, they were sad that John was dead.
Right.
Again, and let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Their second reaction was, oh, thank God, I wasn't doing the drug that he was doing.
One thing that seems consistent through the years on Saturday Night Live is that there's always one or two people who are telling you about how they'd go home at night and just cry because it was so frustrating. Either nothing was being written for them, or what they were writing wasn't getting on, or they felt that things were too competitive and they weren't looking good. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, Lorne has always operated a competitive ship. And actually, the Washington Post, where I work, is much the same. Lorne and Ben Bradley, as a matter of fact, have a lot of similarities. I never thought of that before. But the competitiveness is built into it, and people who can't take it do sort of fall by the wayside.
It is not a nurturing environment. If you are a person that craves feedback, you're at the wrong place.
And Lorne is a notorious for withholding praise. Whether he does this as part of a strategy, whether it's just part of his natural sort of shyness and standoffishness, I don't know. But he is not the easiest person in the world to work for. On the other hand, he can be very caring and attentive to people and their problems. And this has endeared him to many of those who work there now and many of those who worked there in the past. And even people he's fired in the book say nice things about him. Yeah, sure, he fired me, but I still admire him. I find that quite amazing. I find Lorne quite amazing.
One of my favorite things that Conan O'Brien said was that when he was a writer on the show, he would be walking down the hall and Lorne would pass him and just look at him and say, "Still with the show, Conan?" You know, it's that kind of environment.
My guests are Tom Shales and James Andrew Miller, authors of the new book Live from New York, An Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the history of Saturday Night Live with Tom Shales and James Andrew Miller, authors of a new oral history of the show called Live from New York. Saturday Night Live has always been famous for political sketches and for political impressions, you know, impressions of presidents and first ladies and congressmen, senators. And I think that became particularly true during the Bush-Gore presidential race. Saturday Night Live became very famous for the impressions in that. I'm wondering if you got any insights about what was happening politically behind the scenes in that era, and whether there was a lot of political agreement or disagreement on the part of the writers and the performers about how Bush and Gore should be portrayed. Can you talk about that a little, what happened behind the scenes politically?
I think it's never been a question of orthodoxies. I think that one of the things that turns the writers and Lorne on about these political creatures is their behavior and the kind of image that we have of them. So when Al Gore kind of starts huffing and puffing, going like this when W is talking during debate, you know, he kept on doing that during the first debate.
Sighing.
They went to town on that, and they went to town so much that the Gore campaign wound up showing that to Gore the weekend after the sketch had appeared, to show him that he shouldn't sigh so much in the next debate. Those are the kind of things that turn them on. I think that they get the kind of, they tap into the zeitgeist by really kind of coming up with what the American people really think about the president or the candidate, and then they go to town with that. You know, when Will Ferrell was doing W in the 2000 election, I mean, Ralph Nader himself told us it was something you just had to watch because it was another way of understanding these people, and the writers and the performers really got off on that. Sometimes they're so far ahead of the curve, it's amazing. I remember Phil Hartman did a sketch as Bill Clinton right when Clinton was, you know, first on the national scene, and he was jogging and he stopped into a McDonald's and started eating everybody's hamburgers and drinking their shakes. And one of the Secret Service men said, "Well, Mr. President, we just won't tell the First Lady that, you know, you had this shake." And Clinton looked at him, or Phil Hartman in this case, and said, "Son, there's a lot of things we won't be telling Mrs. Clinton." And it was just, I mean, it was so great. And it was obviously years and years before Lewinsky and or anything like that. But they just tap into something that, you know, sticks with the culture.
Saturday Night Live has had its ups and downs over the years. What do you consider the worst year, the worst cast?
I think that there was probably, in my opinion, I guess there were two. One was the cast that started in 1980, when Gene Demanian took over after Lorne and the original cast had left. And that was when she was going to build the show around Charlie Rocket, and which that was...
the rocket that never launched.
The rocket that never launched. And then in 1985, Lorne's first year back, he had decided to take a page from Dick Ebersol, who the year before had, rather than pick unknowns, he had put together like Billy Crystal and Marty Short and Chris Guest. That was a fantastic year. But the next year, 1985, Lorne picked a bunch of people who really weren't ready for Saturday Night Live, even though they had done other movies. And Michael Hall was in that, and Randy Quaid. And
it was a weird grab bag. And Al Franken told us one of the problems was you couldn't do a Senate sketch. You couldn't do a presidential political sketch because there were nobody to play those parts. They were just either these... untried kids, including Robert Downey Jr., who tried many things as the years would go by, or else Randy Quaid, who stuck out like the proverbial sore thumb. It was a weird group. Now, I would completely agree with Jim on which those were the two worst casts.
It's funny because Robert Downey Jr. And Randy Quaid are both really good actors, although they didn't work on Saturday Night Live very well.
Well, that's part of the legacy of Saturday Night Live as well, because look at Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who is incredibly talented and kept us laughing for 10 years on Seinfeld. She was on Saturday Night Live and, you know, really was like a Porsche going 40 miles an hour. She never, ever really got to do anything that showed her talents. And anybody looking at her during her time there would have thought, you know, well, this is just somebody who's really not going to make it. Luckily, Larry David, who created Seinfeld, was one of the writers at that time, and he saw something in her that, you know, you really couldn't see from the sketches. Sometimes Saturday Night Live is not the best vehicle for figuring out whether somebody's truly talented.
But, you know, remember Bill Murray, it took months for Bill Murray to finally be, to put himself over on the air. And he had to, and one way he had to do it was to sit down and talk into the camera and say, "My name is Bill Murray. I'm not really making it on the show. I don't quite understand why." And he had this little dialogue with viewers, and it worked. And then suddenly his kind of character was something new, and people began to see what was funny about it. And today, I would say the most imitated performer in the history of Saturday Night Live, and I may be wrong, is Bill Murray. You can still see on ESPN, in commercials, on other sitcoms, there's always a guy trying to be that kind of hip, disconnected, irreverent, super cool guy that Bill Murray played way back when. He was the prototype. I think he invented a new comic character, and it's become just part of American folklore.
One of the more bizarre moments on Saturday Night Live was a few years ago when the singer Sinead O'Connor, after doing a song, held up a photo of the Pope, or a picture of the Pope, and then tore it to shreds in front of the camera. Something I understand was not rehearsed. What was that about? What happened behind the scenes afterwards?
Well, the first thing that happened was Dave Wilson, who was the director, made sure that they didn't push the applause sign. So there was dead silence in Studio 8H. It was a terrifying moment for a lot of people there because it was so unexpected. She had not told anyone, and not even Lauren. I mean, no one expected it. And she had just done the dress rehearsal about an hour before, and, you know, everything was fine. And then she said during, between dress and air, that she was going to show something at the end of her song. And so she wanted the director to be aware of that so they would get the close-up.
I think she specified a picture of a hungry child or something.
Right. Yeah.
And they even had one at dress rehearsal. They had a picture of a hungry child.
But no one knew what she was going to do. So the media reaction was just, you know, nobody could believe it happened. The great thing about Lauren, though, afterwards, instead of being really ticked, he said, "Well, I was awfully courageous of her." And he just somehow he saw the, you know, her gumption. And
he admired the gesture, but he did not admire being tricked or being lied to. That made him mad. And they had set it up so methodically where they said, "Now, can you just have it one camera on her, not, you know, don't have any other cameras to switch to?" So they were trapped with one shot of Sinead O'Connor. The only thing they could have gone to would have been a reaction shot of the audience, which would have been worse, I suppose, at that point when she tore up the picture. So Lauren may have admired the gesture in some philosophical way, but they were just furious that she would lie to them and trick them. And I don't think she's ever been invited back. In fact, her career didn't exactly skyrocket after that.
My guests are Tom Shales and James Andrew Miller, authors of the new book Live from New York, An Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the history of Saturday Night Live with Tom Shales and James Andrew Miller, authors of a new oral history of the show called Live from New York. I bet one of the things you asked a lot of people from Saturday Night Live was to share their nightmare moments, the moment that was just like the worst moment of their career on Saturday Night Live. Can you tell us about a couple of the nightmare moments?
Actually, a lot of the nightmare moments on the show wind up happening behind the scenes. I think that when you get to the sketch stage of the show, when you're live at 11:30, things are pretty well nailed down.
Lauren doesn't like ad-libbing, and he doesn't like breaking up over a sketch, and he thinks it looks phony. And so when that happens, I think he sometimes chastises people. But on the other hand, sometimes it's so good-natured and inescapable. You know, Brendan Fraser was on and his wig fell off and drooped down over his head, and somehow they all got the giggles, and the audience began to laugh. The audience likes being there when something goes wrong because they think they're privy to this secret information, which, of course, is going out to 14 million homes. But anyway, it seems like something. You know, these days, if you watch Saturday Night Live live, you may see that show, you may see the show that way that time only. It may never again be repeated in that form because if something does go wrong, Lorne now has the option. They tape every dress rehearsal, so he has the option of pulling the sketch out of dress rehearsal and plopping it into the space where it was in the live show. He can re-edit shows for when they're rerun later. And so Saturday Night Live is still an event in the sense that this could be the only time the show is performed exactly that way, complete with those mistakes. I remember once they did, this sounds so trivial, and it is, but they did a sketch with that horrible Tom Green, who brought his own writers, and nobody liked him. But anyway, they had a little baby pig in this sketch, and the pig squealed and squealed and squealed and seemed so unhappy and miserable. And I was at home, and I was furious, thinking, you know, it's not funny to torture any animal, even a pig. And Lorne had an angry letter from some girl, a little girl in the audience, posted outside his office for weeks after that. Well, anyway, that was never seen again, because they simply threw that out and picked up the same sketch from the dress rehearsal where the pig was not in distress and plopped that into the space where it had been. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Did they ever rerun the show with Sinead O'Connor? And what did they do with that?
Yeah, they rerun it all right, but they put the dress rehearsal performance in.
Huh.
So never again will you see her, except in a news program, in news footage, never will you see in a Saturday Night Live her tearing up a picture of the Pope.
Tom Shales, you've been a TV critic for The Washington Post for many years. I imagine you've written a lot about Saturday Night Live over the years, some good things and some bad things. Did you actually interview people for this book who you'd given bad reviews to over the years, who maybe didn't really want to talk to you?
Just Chevy. I was afraid of Chevy, partly for that reason. And Chevy and I, we go way, way back, because the first season, Saturday Night Live, you know, skyrocketed into the public consciousness. They all came to Washington to be part of some White House correspondents' dinner. You know, we have 800 dinners here every year. And so Lorne invited me to spend the day with them. So I followed them around, Lorne and Chevy and John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd, and they were wonderful. They made up bits wherever we were. They would do improvisations just for each other, and I got to enjoy them. And then after a few hours, I heard Chevy say to Lorne, loudly enough so that I could hear it, "Is this guy going to be with us all the time? About me?" And I thought, well, gee, how rude. Lorne said, you know, "Shut up, Chevy," or something like that. And then years later, I reviewed Chevy's first special when after he left the show, he got a deal to do specials for NBC, and he invited me to come with him to Glen Sound in L.A. I don't know why I was in L.A., to mix the sound. And he sat there being very cocky at the console, telling the engineer to, you know, punch up the laughter. Give us a bigger laugh here, you know, sweetening the laughter, just as on the most corrupt kind of sitcom. You know, give this a guffaw. Oh, make this laughter last longer. And I thought, my, he's sold out in a big way. He certainly has gone over to the enemy side. So I wrote a negative review of that. And, of course, I heard from him then that he said, boy, you guys really change your tunes, don't you, or something like that. It seems like every time I'm near him, something bad happens. That's why I was so glad when Jim interviewed him at length for the book and got such great stuff out of him. I don't think I could ever have done that interview. I interviewed him briefly with Lorne in the room so that he couldn't hit me. But I still get very nervous around Chevy.
Tom Shales, as a TV critic for The Washington Post, what do you think of Saturday Night Live now?
I love it. It's an amazing phenomenon. It's a cliche, but it reinvents itself all the time. And it has its down years, and then it bounces back up again. And yeah. I've never been one to get hysterical or, you know, to say that the world is ending like Chicken Little when they, you know, when they go through a slump, except for the time when Gene Dumanian took over the show. And I was proud of the lead I wrote because everybody else was writing Saturday Night Dead. But what I wrote was Vile from New York. It's Saturday Night. I did an anagram. But that was the only time I lost all hope for the show. And even then, it came back. So I think the amazing self-rejuvenation properties of that show are very encouraging.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. Thank you, Tom Shales. Thank you, Jim Miller.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tom Shales and James Andrew Miller are the authors of the new book, Live from New York, An Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live.